Let's turn to Zechariah chapter 6. If you'll notice from the board, I don't actually expect to cover the whole chapter today, but I plan to read the whole chapter and cover most of it. This chapter contains the last of the visions that Zechariah received at night, as well as what might look like an appendix, but is in some ways the climax of the series of visions, and as well as a summary of them. So Zechariah chapter 6, beginning at verse 1. Then I turned and raised my eyes and looked, and behold, four chariots were coming from between two mountains, and the mountains were mountains of bronze. With the first chariot were red horses, with the second chariot black horses, with the third chariot white horses, and with the fourth chariot dappled horses, strong steeds. Then I answered and said to the angel who talked with me, "What are these, my lord?" And the angel answered and said to me, "These are the four spirits of heaven who go out from their station before the Lord of all the earth. The one with the black horses is going to the north country. The white are going after them, and the dappled are going toward the south country." Then the strong steeds went out, eager to go, that they might walk to and fro throughout the earth. And he said, "Go, walk to and fro throughout the earth." So they walked to and fro throughout the earth. And he called to me and spoke to me, saying, "See, those who go toward the north country have given rest to my spirit in the north country." Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, "Receive the spirit from the captives, from Heldai, Tobijah, and Jediah, who have come from Babylon, and go on the same day and enter the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah. Take the silver and gold, make an elaborate crown, and set it on the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Then speak to him, saying, 'Thus says the Lord of hosts, saying, Behold, the man whose name is the Branch. From his place he shall branch out, and he shall build the temple of the Lord. Yes, he shall build the temple of the Lord. He shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule on his throne. So he shall be a priest on his throne. And the council of peace shall be between them both. Now the elaborate crown shall be for a memorial in the temple of the Lord, for Helam, Tobijah, Jediah, and Hen, the son of Zephaniah. Even those from afar shall come and build the temple of the Lord. Then you shall know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. And this shall come to pass if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God." As I said, the first part of this chapter is the last of the visions, the vision of four chariots coming out between two mountains of bronze. And the last part of the chapter, beginning at verse 9, is sort of the climax, reiteration of many of the ideas we've seen in the last, in the first several visions. So the point of the vision is that these chariots represent the coming of God's judgment on his enemies and the final day of destruction for the enemies. That point, the idea of destruction may not be completely apparent, and so I thought at the beginning I would just go through and point out how the language encourages that. When we think of chariots, I don't know, we may not get before Ben-Hur, which is, you know, chariot races, and it looked pretty dangerous, but not the idea of judgment. But chariots were the tanks of their time. They were used for destruction. And if you want to contrast, in fact, it's helpful here to think of the first vision. The visions of Zechariah are in some ways paired, like the first and the last and the next to the last and the second and so on. But in the first vision, it's been a while, but back in chapter 1, you remember there were horses also sent out. The colors were different and the numbers weren't so clear, but they were horses for reconnaissance. Okay, so they were scouting out the territory, as it were, and bringing back information to the angel of the Lord and to the Lord himself. But here, the chariots and horses are not on a reconnaissance mission. So you don't use a chariot for reconnaissance, or you didn't. I guess you don't use them at all now, but chariots are not for reconnaissance. Chariots were for destruction and judgment. And that point, I think, is maybe clear if we look at a couple of other references where this idea of chariots being used as the forces of God are before us. Okay, let's go ahead and look at those, then we can look at the specific language here. But turn with me to a familiar passage, 2 Kings 6:17. It may not sound familiar, but the reference may not sound familiar, but I know you know the passage, Chariots of Fire. In 2 Kings chapter 6, Elisha is apparently in trouble. He and his servant find themselves surrounded, as you can see in verse 15, for example, surrounded by an army with horses and chariots. Okay, that's like a human army with horses and chariots, and they see themselves in trouble. And so I'll actually back up to verse 16 of 2 Kings 6. So he, Elisha, answered to his servant, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So there's the same idea that the chariots not only match, you might say, the chariots of the human army, but they overmatch them. They are horses and chariots of fire surrounding them. And the same sort of idea, I think maybe we won't turn there, is in Psalm 68, where it talks about the chariots of God being myriads, thousands and ten thousands of chariots are at God's command. Now, turn back to Zechariah 6. In the text itself, you can see the significance of this in terms of a force of power and destruction. Verse 3 at the end, it says, "These are strong steeds." Same thing at verse 7. They're strong steeds who go out. And they're described as being eager for their mission. And verse 7, they're eager to go. The idea comes up in other ways also. The reference to the winds or the spirits in verse 5. Zechariah asks what's by now his characteristic question, "What are these, my Lord?" Okay, he sees the vision, and repeatedly through the series of visions, he in effect says, "Huh?" Okay, so we shouldn't make fun of Zechariah. We could hardly understand this without the Lord's aid. And the answer is given to him, "These are the four spirits of heaven who go out from their station before the Lord of all the earth." Now, the word spirit could be wind. They are angelic beings, but the picture of the four spirits reinforces the idea of the destructiveness of them, especially if you take the shade of meaning of the wind, considering the wind we had this last weekend in Stillwater, especially those who are camping out and washing cars in it. I hardly need to explain that further. But I put up on the board several references where God uses the winds for destruction, or the destructive power of God is compared to the wind. Jeremiah 49 and 51 are a couple of references like that. The connection with the spirits and the angelic beings comes in the fact that God often refers to the angelic forces as winds doing his will, or their forces associated with winds. And again, I'll just point out some references in Psalm 18 and 104 and so on. I'm going lightly over this part because we won't get very far in the whole chapter, but there is a rich Old Testament background, that's what I'm saying, to this picture of the chariots going forth and the four spirits and the force that's represented here. Now, these are sent by God. Our references already suggest that, but you can see at the end of verse 5, "These go out from their station before the Lord of all the earth." So it is the presence of God that these represent. These are forces going out with power. And the emphasis on the presence of God is probably also brought out in the ideas of the mountains of bronze. Okay, now, there's a lot of discussion about what the mountains represent and what the bronze represents. Bronze is an alloy, and it can sometimes represent strength or One commentator suggests it represents the brightness here, that this would have been a stunning picture for Zechariah to see. But probably the easiest association between the mountains of bronze and the presence of God is in the construction of Solomon's temple. Remember, there were bronze pillars, and again, the reference is on the board there in 1 Kings chapter 7. They're bronze pillars which supported the exterior of the temple that Solomon built. And so that would reinforce the idea that these spirits are coming from the presence of God. Now, what is it then, given that background, given that they're on a mission of attack and destruction, what is it that they're going to do? And the description is given in verses 6 and 7 and 8. And that is one group of horses, or actually two groups of horses, are going to the north country. The black horses and the white horses are going to the north country, and the dappled are going toward the south country. Now, this seems a little strange to us. We would expect there to be an east and a west, and some people who want to help out the Bible supply those directions in their translations, but there is nothing in the original about east and west. There is the sense of comprehensiveness, and the four spirits probably does represent going throughout the earth, and you can see the emphasis on going throughout the earth in verse 7. There's actually a tremendous emphasis on that. So there is, certainly in the text, the comprehensiveness, but the two directions of north and south are the only ones that are mentioned. And probably the best explanation is the simplest one, and that is that's the way the roads ran. Okay, you don't go very far to the east or the west of Palestine if you're just traveling. You go to the north, and then from the north you can go in different directions. So since I'll focus on the north, let me just mention probably the south country especially would represent the ancient enemy Egypt. The Egyptians were, of course, long-standing opposers to the people of God. It was from Egypt that they had escaped in the Exodus by the power of God. But here, besides the north country, there's a special emphasis on, besides the south country, there's a special emphasis on the north country. And I've mentioned this before, and I'm sure you're familiar with the fact, but when we think of the north, we might not think of Assyria and Babylon and Persia, but that's what's represented. Okay, again, it's just the way the geography was that the north country typically represented especially the Babylonians. And you may remember back a couple of chapters earlier, they were encouraged to flee out of the north, and that would be to return from Babylon in the immediate reference. So the fact that the horses are going to the north country shows that God is sending out these forces of judgment on especially the ancient enemies of God's people. In the north, Babylon and all that it represents, and in the south, Egypt. Now, the destruction that God would bring on Babylon is fulfillment of what we've seen elsewhere in the scriptures. Our pastor has been preaching through Isaiah, and so we've seen references there that God's judgment would come on the Babylonians. They had taken God's people into captivity and had gone, you might say, beyond their mandate in their arrogance and the cruelty towards God's people. So this represents the judgment of God that's going to come against them. But as I mentioned before, in connection with that fleeing from the north in our earlier discussion in Zechariah, Babylon comes to represent in the scriptures not merely one country, but the whole system of opposition against God's people. It's the city of man against the city of God, as it were. And you can see that by many places. The easiest place is just to look at the book of Revelation, where Babylon is identified as the locus, the central point of opposition to God's people, the one who would seek to destroy God's people. And so I think the imagery here encourages us, just as it has earlier in Zechariah, not simply to think of God saying, I'm going to get them Babylonians, but as an encouragement to the people of God that though they were weak, God's force could come against anyone who was arrayed in opposition to them. God's people at this time were weak. They had a task to do, but they felt frustrated in it and had turned away from building the temple. They were surrounded by hostile people in their immediate vicinity. Those who had been resettled in the Samaritan lands and elsewhere were hostile to God's people. So their sense of futility and smallness would be overwhelming. And the encouragement that's given to them in this vision is God's power is quite sufficient to overcome all the opposition of the enemies. Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. Okay, not very far back in Zechariah, that statement. And that's the encouragement that comes to them. His spirit, the power of his spirit, is sufficient to overthrow all of the enemies. And that picture then of the North Country and the opposition is, as I said, really expanded throughout biblical history. If you look in the book of Ezekiel, where is it that the apocalyptic opposers of God's people, you know, the last days that Ezekiel seems to be describing in chapters 38 and 39, Gog and Magog, well, whoever they are, and I'm not going to identify them with any current geopolitical structures, whoever they are, they come from the north. And that you can look at the references in Ezekiel to see that. So that, and the book of Revelation at the end in chapter 20 identifies those as the ones who seek to destroy the people of God in the new covenant, right? It's not limited to the Old Testament, as I already mentioned, Babylon comes up that way. So the encouragement for us is the same as it was for the people of God. And the commentator Phillips makes this point very well. He says, you know, we should pray the way Elisha prayed, that our eyes would be open and that we would see the chariots of fire surrounding us. The church is small. It seems to have little impact in the world. It seems to be making little progress. Surely the opponents of the church would laugh at such a prophecy, just as the Babylonians would have laughed as they had heard about it. What? Four chariots coming out from Jerusalem? Yeah. What has that got to do with us? In this time, actually, the Babylonians had already been overthrown. But the powers of the world could laugh at the people of God. But the chariots of God were quite sufficient to frustrate the plans of the Syrians in Elisha's time. And they're quite sufficient to accomplish his purpose. And that's really the point in verse 8 and the conclusion of the vision. He called me. This is the angel who's speaking to him. And as we've seen in other visions, the angel is not merely an angel, but the angel of the Lord, because he refers to my spirit. He says, see, those who go toward the north country have given rest to my spirit in the north country. Now, this given rest to my spirit may seem like sort of a strange thing to say, but that giving rest is used elsewhere in the Old Testament in connection with the pouring out of God's wrath. And it's in the pouring out of God's wrath that God has that rest, that his wrath is, as it were, satisfied. And so the picture is that because this judgment has come on them, they are able to enter into a period of rest and prosperity. Now, the connection with the time of Zechariah is probably helpful. I was going to skip this reference, but let's look at it. It's Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 10. Why would they want to know that the Spirit of God is at rest? Why would they want to know that this conquest had taken place? Well, it would tie in with the charge which had originally been given to them when they were on the borders of the Promised Land through Moses. Let me back up a little bit. This is the command to build a temple for God, or immediately tabernacle, but this is before they've entered the Promised Land. I'll back up to verse 8 of Deuteronomy 12. You shall not at all do as we are doing here today, every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. For as yet you have not come to the rest and the inheritance which the Lord your God is giving you. But when you cross over the Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies round about so that you dwell in safety, then there will be the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. There you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes and heave offerings of your hand, and all your choice offerings which you vow to the Lord. And then it goes on from there. But you see the connection between God giving them rest from their enemies and going to the place of worship. And that's That's what the imagery in Zechariah would have suggested to them. If God's spirit is at rest because of the overthrow of his enemies, then they are therefore free to proceed with the building of the temple. And this also ties in with the larger imagery of the Bible. So I mentioned Revelation 20. Well, what is it that follows the final overthrow of God's enemies in Revelation 20? Well, it's the rest of the new heavens and the new earth. It's that coming down of the new city Jerusalem, which has no temple because God himself is the temple, but which represents the consummation of this temple to which they've been pointed repeatedly in Zechariah. So this last of the visions corresponds to the first in the sense that there was a reconnaissance mission, and what was the message? Okay, this is like a pop quiz from the second week of class, sorry. What was the message of the reconnaissance mission? It was, all the nations are at rest. And that was bad news, because the nations were unconcerned about the weak estate of God's people. But here, it's God who's at rest and his people, because he has chastised the nations. Now, that's not the end of the story. If you're worried that, you know, the destruction of the nations means like people in Oklahoma too, well, that's not the end of the story. That's actually contained in chapter 6 and the last part, but the part I didn't expect to get to this week. God has promised to gather in the nations. So there is a discrimination in his wrath. It's those who are utterly opposed to the people of God, who seek to destroy them, who are overthrown. But God has already promised to gather in his treasures from among the nations and to worship him. So that you'll have to wait for next week. But let me pause there and see if you have any comments or questions so far on the last of the visions. You notice I didn't say anything about what the colors mean. Okay. If you want to know... Ask Dan if you want to know what the color would be, right? Anyway. Any questions?
You mentioned the one part of the chariots where sometimes is it translated as coming from all directions, or when you said something like helpfully supplied?
Some translations put in the other directions, yes.
Okay. Is that you somehow to misinterpret the prophecy?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the idea of going throughout the whole earth is certainly there in verse 7. But one should be opposed in principle to adding what one thinks should be in the Bible. Yeah. Okay. Let's look at then the last part, beginning at verse 9 of chapter 6. This is, as I said, is not a vision. It's an acted out prophecy. This sort of action you can find elsewhere in the prophets. For example, in the book of Kings, you know, there are various false prophets putting on various props from where their storage was, and good prophets did the same thing. We might think of Ezekiel especially for doing some fairly bizarre things. But here, the prophet Zechariah is told to act out something. It's to put a crown on the head of Joshua the high priest. And the purpose of the putting on the crown is to assure them that the prophecy of verses 12 and 13, the oracle there, will come to pass. So just to summarize, the main point of this is that by putting this crown on Joshua the high priest, the Lord is assuring the people that the branch, the Messiah, will come. He is the king and the priest, and he will be the ultimate builder of the temple. Now, we've actually looked at those verses 12 and 13 more than once because the reference to the branch occurs earlier in Zechariah, and this is a fuller explanation. It's a fuller explanation of the combination of priest and king in the Messiah. And so I'm not going to maybe spend as long looking at the background of some of the words because we've talked about it. But I want to think about it a little bit and see how it would have applied to them and how it encourages us also. The first thing that comes in the passage is a command to go to these captives. And the idea is probably these are people who have come back from Babylon, maybe fairly recently. And they brought with them silver and gold. Now, the silver and gold is appropriated for the use of this crown, so we can hope that they had meant it as a gift to God ultimately. Anyway, it was adapted for the purpose of the Lord, whatever they had intended for it. So these captives come back, and Zechariah is sent to take from them the silver and the gold and make a crown. Now, the same fellows come up again at the end of the chapter in the verses 14 and 15, and it's that connection that I think I'm going to wait till next week to discuss. It does have to do with this idea of the bringing in of those who were scattered from afar, including the Gentiles. We should be interested in that point. But I'm going to hold off on that and not talk as much about these three fellows. Let's think a little bit about the crown that's made and then especially about the prophecy. So, Zechariah is told to take the silver and the gold and make an elaborate crown. That's the way the New King James Version has it. And if you look at the translation footnote in the New King James Version, you can see it literally, it's crowns. There's some dispute about this, but it apparently is a plural noun. But when it's used with the verb is always in the singular. So the idea probably of an elaborate crown is a good translation. It's some compound silver and gold. You don't actually mix silver and gold together to make a crown. That doesn't work very well. But it could be like a circlet of silver with a gold crown or some combination. There's a fascinating connection here in the book of Revelation when Jesus in chapter 9 is seen as coming with many crowns on his head. And that may be the same idea here as, it doesn't make sense to have these all sort of piled up on top of your head, many crowns, but the elaborate crown or the rich and ornate crown is certainly an emphasis on the royalty here. Okay, so Zechariah is to take the silver and the gold and to make a crown. And on whose head would we expect a crown to be put? Well, surely it would be put on the head of the king. Okay, and if you don't get this point, then you're not going to get much of the rest of the point of the prophecy. It's not put on the head of the king. They don't have a king. The closest they have is this fellow Zerubbabel we've been talking about for a while, and he is the civil ruler. He's the governor under the authority of the Persians. And here's actually another place where the translators sometimes are too helpful, and they stick Zechariah's name in here. Zechariah's name does not appear in the Hebrew text. It's Joshua who gets the crown. Joshua is the high priest. Okay? Now, we should say there's something strange going on here. I mean, we've come to expect that with Zechariah. I mean, no disrespect, but he always makes a point and gets our attention. And just as with the elaborate flow of oil, he being God actually gets our attention. So here, the point is made, there's something unusual because this crown is put on the head of the high priest. Now, we are not left to wonder what that means, thankfully, because the interpretation is given to us in verses 12 and 13. And that's where I want to focus our discussion. Behold the man whose name is the branch. Now, the reference to the branch, as I said, has already occurred in Zechariah. We've seen Old Testament references beginning, well, way back, for example, in Isaiah. The idea of the branch doesn't come through as well in the English word. It's something very insignificant, right? It's that little stubble in the ground after you cut down the tree and think you got rid of it. It's that little bit that represents future growth. Okay, that's the idea of the branch. And the point here is that the branch is a king and a priest. And he is ultimately the one who will build the temple of the Lord. Now, I want to try to remind you of some of the Old Testament background. We've looked at this a little bit, but I said before that the idea of the king building a temple is a little foreign to us. Okay, so normally, federal money doesn't go toward building churches. I suppose there are exceptions, but here in the Old Testament and actually in the ancient Near East, it wasn't unusual for the king especially to be in charge of the place of worship, at least as far as funding its building and maintenance. And to see the larger messianic context, I'd like to turn to a passage I think we skipped before, and that's in 2 Samuel. So keep your finger here. There's a good bit of Old Testament background that Zechariah draws on. We've seen this already many times in the study. Zechariah assumes you've already read the first part of the book, or God does, assumes you've already read the first part of his book, and Zechariah draws freely on the Old Testament imagery and background. And here, especially in 2 Samuel 7, is the covenant with David. Remember, David had wanted to build a temple for God because the ark was in a temporary location still. And God, as it were, corrects David and says that instead God will build a house. That's the imagery that's used for David. Let me pick up the reading in 2 Samuel 7, verse 12. God speaking to David says, "When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with a rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever." So here the word of the Lord through Nathan to David is that David's wish will be fulfilled. That is, that God will have a house built for him. But it's not David who will do it. Now, in the immediate context, it is David's physical son Solomon who builds the temple, and the chastening with the rods of men and so forth would have immediate reference to Solomon and those who followed him, who frequently needed chastening. But the ultimate fulfillment is in the Messiah, and the New Testament, for example, uses this way. Psalm 89 also refers this to the Messiah. "I will be his father, and he shall be my son." And the Lord Jesus is the one ultimately whose throne is established forever and the one who builds the house of God. Okay? So I wanted to bring that up not to tell you something you already knew about Jesus, but to remind you of the connection between the building of the temple and the royal line. Okay? This is a connection that, as I said, we might not naturally make, but was fundamental. That was a basic covenant arrangement that God had made. Keep in mind that covenant arrangement for the last part of our study, but that's the commandment that is given then. So go back to Zechariah chapter 6. That's the background then of the connection between the king building and the king and the building of the temple of the Lord. And that's repeated at the end of verse 12. "He shall build the temple of the Lord." At the beginning of verse 13, "Yes, he shall build the temple of the Lord." That has to do with a certain poetic arrangement of ideas that's here. There's a special emphasis on the work that he will do. There's also an emphasis on the fact that, there's a play on the word branch. "Behold, the man whose name is the branch, from his place he shall branch out." Okay, as I said, the idea of a branch is something fairly insignificant. But the branching out refers to the sprouting and growing, the flourishing of this branch, which is unexpected. Okay, I'll remind you that the idea of the branch occurs in Isaiah 53, and the flourishing occurs. I haven't quite got there yet, but the flourishing has already been hinted at, and I guess last week, and will be developed later on. But that aspect in Isaiah 53 emphasizes the priestly aspect. The kingly aspect of the branch is something that I mentioned before, but I'd like to emphasize one more time. And here I have to choose between Jeremiah 23 and Jeremiah 33. Well, let's go with Jeremiah 33. They're very similar references, but this again is to emphasize that not only is the branch connected with the priestly work of the Messiah, but in fact, you might say the main emphasis in the Old Testament use of the branch is with the kingly work. And here you can see this, especially in the great so-called Book of Hope of Jeremiah, where the days that are coming and the new covenant are described. So Jeremiah 33, beginning at verse 14, Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I will perform that good thing which I have promised to the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. In those days and at that time I will cause to grow up to David a branch of righteousness. He shall execute judgment and righteousness in the earth. In those days Judah will be saved and Jerusalem will dwell safely. And this is the name by which she will be called, the Lord our righteousness. The parallel reference in Jeremiah 23 says this is the name by which he will be called. So the branch is the Lord our righteousness. And she, Jerusalem, gets that name because of his association with her. In any case, you can see the connection with David. I will cause to grow up to David a branch of righteousness, which is a connection that was made earlier in the book of Isaiah also. So the emphasis on the branch as being in the line of David then, you can go back to Zechariah one more time, is in the background for what Zechariah says. Now the promise that was given in 2 Samuel that David's line would continue was never broken, but you might say it was in a sense suspended. During this time period there was no king actually sitting on the throne. There was a line of David continually, but there was no one sitting on the throne. And there's a fascinating reference in Ezekiel 21 where symbolically Ezekiel says, take the crown off of the head of this particularly nasty king of the southern kingdom. And then it's to be taken off and kept until the one comes to whom it belongs. Because we've been looking at several references, so we won't turn there. But that again is in the background of the promise here. The one to whom it belongs is here, present, as it were. And that's where the promise is based. So then, so far what we've seen is that this fellow Joshua stands in for someone else. Okay, he couldn't really be the branch. Joshua is not in the line of David, in case you missed that, right? He's a priest, he's not in the line of David. Zerubbabel is not mentioned here, he can't be the fulfillment of this. This has to be looking forward to someone future. Okay? And the temple that is to be built then must not be the literal temple, which they are continually pointed to in the book of Zechariah, but rather the anti-type for that temple. That is, the physical temple they were building was to look forward to what the Messiah would do. Since we've talked about this point several times in Zechariah already, I won't dwell on that point. Jesus refers to his body as the temple. One greater than the temple is with you, he says, when he's in the vicinity of the literal physical temple of his day. But when they destroyed the body of the temple, he raised it up, and that led to the building of the church, which is really the emphasis of the New Testament. Because we've talked about that, I didn't put up any references on the board, but again and again, the New Testament emphasizes that we are the church, we are the temple that God is building through Christ. So the main point then is clear. This one will come, and it will be an encouragement to them because although they felt nothing would ever happen, they have before them this acted out demonstration that God will fulfill his promises. And they will have their part then in leading to that. Now, the main part of the application is in verse 15, so I'm going to have to sort of leave that for later. But I want to focus a little bit more on the last part, and that's especially verse 13, which I haven't said that much about yet. He shall bear the glory is a reference to the glorious attire that the king would wear. So it is an emphasis on the glorious nature of his rule. He shall sit and rule on his throne. And then the last two clauses of verse 13, so he shall be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both. Okay, now here's a point where translations differ. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this. So he shall be a priest on his throne is what the New King James Version says. The ESV has something else. Could you read that clause, Logan? You have
in verse 13.
Yeah, it's the fourth clause there. Instead of he shall be a priest on his throne, something like there will be a...
And there shall be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both.
Okay. There shall be a priest on his throne. Okay, so the question is whether Zechariah is saying under the inspiration of the Spirit, the branch will be a priest on his throne, or whether he is saying that there will also be a priest. He's going to be a king, that's clear. But is he saying, in addition to there being a king there, there will be a priest beside him, or on his throne? That's the question. Okay? And the Hebrew could be translated either way. Okay? This is not the case of what I was talking about before, where people just mess with the text or something. The Hebrew could be translated either way. Does everyone see the distinction? Is the branch the subject of that clause? He shall be a priest on his throne. Is it referring to the branch? Or is it sort of vague in general, saying there will be a priest on his throne? And most people say, well, you know, it's referring to someone else who will be a priest with him. I don't know Hebrew. Either translation is appropriate. It's funny, if you read a commentator who talks about the Hebrew and argues for, say, the New King James Version translation, he'll say, well, the Hebrew could go anyway, but if he had wanted to say there will be a priest, then he would have said this in the Hebrew. And then you read someone who likes the ESV translation and says, well, the Hebrew could go anyway, but if he had wanted to say the other way, he would have said it this way in Hebrew. So, okay. So, to me, that means that you have to let the larger context determine what's going on. And if you look at the verbs, who is the subject of the verb in the previous clauses? It's the branch every time, right? He shall build the temple of the Lord. Yes, he shall build the temple of the Lord. He shall bear the glory and shall sit and rule on his throne. It makes sense then that he shall be a priest on his throne as well. It would be a little strange to introduce another unknown figure here when we've been talking about the branch. But what's more conclusive to me is the fact that the whole vision is about who's being crowned? Joshua. And who does Joshua stand for? The branch. And what is Joshua's day job, besides, you know, standing around being crowned? He's a high priest, right? So it makes sense that the whole point of the demonstration is that the branch will be both king and priest. Now, the ESV may be sort of, you know, preserving the ambiguity and simply saying there shall be a priest on his throne and not saying for sure it's someone separate. But it seems fairly clear to me that it's saying that the branch will sit and rule as a king and as a priest. Now, again, there's Old Testament background for that, and I'd like to turn just to Psalm 110. Psalm 110 refers to the Messiah. Okay, again, we don't have to conjecture that. Jesus himself says that, applies the psalm to himself. Psalm 110, a psalm of David. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion. Rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people shall be volunteers in the day of your power. In the beauties of holiness, from the womb of the morning you have the dew of your youth. The Lord has sworn and will not relent. You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. Okay, so familiar psalm, I won't read anymore. But Jehovah is saying to David's Lord that he should sit at his right hand. So there's the kingly rule of the Messiah. But in verse 4, this same person is told that he will be a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. Now, the connection then is that he is both a king and a priest. This is not news to you. I don't suppose I need to emphasize the point very much, but I will remind you that Melchizedek also had those offices. The writer to the Hebrews brings that point out. And that point is extremely important for understanding how Christ saves us. He is not only a king, but also a priest. And that's the emphasis here. He will bear the glory. He shall sit and rule on his throne. So he shall be a priest on his throne. He saves as a crowned Joshua, as one who is king and priest. Now, I'd hope to talk about the Council of Peace phrase, but I don't want to push it. And so let me just conclude here with the encouragement. Klein, I think, says well the encouragement we should draw from the fact that we have one who is both a king and a priest. He says, "What an astounding advance is marked by Christ's priesthood. It was the greatest privilege afforded by the old covenant cult." That means worship, not like Jehovah's Witnesses or something. "The old covenant cult, that the high priest might enter the earthly holy of holies, he alone, once a year, to stand and minister before the throne of God. But to Christ, the royal priest, it is given to enter the true temple above, to be continually in the heavenly holy of holies, and, the utterly astonishing thing, to ascend the throne and share in the glory of God between the cherubim. In contemplation of this priest-king, fairer than the children of men, arrayed in divine glory and majesty, the psalmist exults, 'Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever.'" That's Psalm 45, which the writer to the Hebrews applies to Jesus. So that is the astounding thing, and something it's too easy for us from our New Testament point of view to forget. But this was a central point of the writer to the Hebrews in Hebrews 8, that we have a priest who is seated at the right hand of God. He has accomplished a work which is extraordinary and brings salvation, that builds the temple of the Lord. Okay, we'll have to wait till next week to figure out the Council of Peace thing. It was really interesting to me. But let me pause here and see if you have any comments or questions. Yes? Yeah. Yeah, it's very striking in itself.
It's interesting because I'm reading along in another translation in another language.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, well, partly. And the word they use translates back to English as twig.
Yeah.
I thought, this sounds disrespectful.
Yeah.
Maybe this is like the Swedish Living Bible or something.
No, in some ways it's better than branch because, I don't know, sometimes when the wind blows in Oklahoma, the branches that come down are pretty big.
Yeah.
But I refer to Isaiah 53. Okay, pastor's been preaching on it, but "He shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground." Okay, that's the idea of the branch. Insignificant, to be ignored, apparently. So the Swedes got it right.
Yes, sir.
Any other comments or questions? Let's close in prayer.